Welcome, members and guests, to the March 4th program of the City Club of Eugene, Assembling the Puzzle of Affordable Housing. As you know, we're meeting today at the UO Baker Downtown Center, which will be our new home for Friday meetings. We'll hear now from Sandra Gladney, UO's Academic Extension's Executive Director.
Thank you, James. I'll just stand on my tippy toes so you don't have to adjust the microphone. Briefly, I just want to welcome you. This is an exciting opportunity to extend our community engagement mission here at Academic Extension. And I can thank Karen Hyatt for helping to facilitate the relationship. Unfortunately, she is not able to be here. She sent me notice that she's homesick today, so we can wish her well. And I'm sure we'll see her at a city club in the near future. In this space, we have this large room that hosts a series of activities, and I would draw your attention to the table over there that has the University of Oregon table skirt with a few brochures. This one in particular demonstrates where we have offices in Portland and Bend, as well as here, with links to the calendars of events at those spaces and a brief summary of some of the programs that we have that could be available to you. Some of you I recognize as OSHA Lifelong Learning Institute members, and we have other programs as well that you might find of interest. So please feel free to pick those up on your way out. And welcome to your first time here. I think we've had a bigger success than James thought, and Todd, our facilities guy, and Mark, I'm sure, will rearrange in the future where we can have even more people. So come on in. We're happy to have you. Thanks.
Okay, I'm James Baldock, City Club President. Our sponsors today are the UO Academic Extension, advancing the UO's missions in innovating teaching, discovery, and service by creating entrepreneurial formats of learning to access the university's community of scholars beyond the conventional campus boundaries. The Network Charter School, a hands-on environment that provides students in grades 7 to 12 with experiential education, incorporating both academic excellence and practical skills, and KLCC, NPR for Western and Central Oregon, as well as the Collegian, private student living built for academic success in Eugene, Oregon. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space, and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the podcast on their website. We'd also like to thank Community Television for Lane County for televising recent City Club programs Monday through Friday at noon, Saturday at 10:30 a.m., and Sunday at 9 p.m. We host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year, and today is our 21st program in our 2015-2016 programming year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please join us. We welcome anyone who has a stake in community life. Before we start today's program, I'm happy to announce that this week we launched a pilot program connected to our larger plans for civic education. Sigvana Topnok, Yesenia Carlos, Tariq Richardson, and Ashley Campbell were named by the NAACP, LULAC, and the UO Office Serving Native American Students to develop projects to engage young people in building a shared vision for our community. On your tables is a short description of their proposed work, among other things. The news update will also be sent to those on our email list and posted on our website. You'll learn more about these projects during the spring. All right. Affordable housing made news twice recently. First, St. Vincent de Paul, a private nonprofit, purchased a mobile home park in Junction City. Then, the Housing and Community Services Agency of Lane County, which included workforce housing, hit a snag when Lane County declined to convert their proposed 99-year lease on the underlying land into an outright sale. These projects address affordable housing differently. Rural versus urban, preserving existing housing versus building new housing, and a private versus public-private partnership approach. Is there a right or and wrong answer for Eugene, or are these just different pieces of a larger puzzle? Our speakers are Executive Directors Terry McDonald of St. Vincent de Paul and Jacob Fox of HASCA. St. Vincent de Paul is Lane County's largest nonprofit human services organization, helping more than 80,000 people annually, 84,000 people annually. It has six core areas: affordable housing, emergency services, homelessness services, recycling programs, thrift stores, and self-sufficiency stores. HASCA provides housing and supportive services to about 4,300 Lane County families a year through Section 8 and public affordable housing programs, as well as energy conservation by weatherization, which they do to about 300 homes each year for low-income renters and property owners. I'll have them come up to the podium here, and let's listen as they describe their efforts to assemble the puzzle that is affordable housing in Eugene.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and I'm honored to be here. My name is Jacob Fox, and I'm the Executive Director for the Housing and Community Services Agency, as I was introduced. But before I begin my presentation, I'd like to see a show of hands for how many folks in the audience feel like they have a good understanding of the mission, programs, and properties that St. Vinny's manages. Just raise your hand if you have a general sense of what they do and who they are. And then why don't I also see a show of hands for folks in the audience that feel like they have a good understanding of the mission, programs, and properties that HACSA manages. So here's an observation from the podium. more folks understand what St. Vinny's does than what the Housing and Community Services does, and I really attribute that to kind of Terry's leadership and vision and the rest of his team. They've really been a bedrock of support for low-income families in this community, and they continue to be. I want to share a little bit about my background and how I came to the Housing and Community Services Agency. In 2010, the HACSA board and the former executive director, Larry Abel, created a five-year strategic plan. And part of the plan called for the creation of a succession plan for Larry. In 2013, I was hired as the deputy director as part of the succession plan, and then last July, Larry retired, and I became the executive director. Because I'm relatively new to the area, I'll just share a little bit about my background. So I've been an affordable housing professional for the last 17 years. I've had the honor of working at three different housing authorities in Southwest Washington, in Portland, and now here in Lane County. I also had the opportunity to work for the City of Portland's Affordable Housing Bureau, and in that capacity, I was in charge of structuring the City of Portland's investment in affordable housing real estate transactions and properties, and then I was also responsible for the City of Portland's 10-year plan on homelessness, and that doesn't mean I did it all myself, of course. We had a great team at the Housing Bureau. But I've been able to kind of see the perspective of a kind of a developer and owner, which is what the Housing Authority is, and then also more of a funder. So I've gotten kind of a perspective from both sides. So for those of you in this room that didn't raise your hand, I wanted to tell you a little bit about HACSA. So we have over a $30 million annual budget. We have 92 employees. Our largest program is the Section 8 program, and that's 3,000 Section 8 vouchers, so 3,000 low-income people we're serving throughout Lane County. That program is roughly $16 million a year. The thing that's neat for me about that program is I consider it also an economic development program. So of that $16 million, roughly $14 million goes directly through us to private landlords in the community, who are serving low-income folks with the Section 8 program. So we also, we're also owners of another 1,500 units of affordable housing. So to break that down a little bit, we have 700 units of what's called public housing. There's 250 units of the Department of Housing and Urban Development project-based Section 8. And then we have another 550 units of a variety of different kinds of affordable housing funded with different types of funding. I'd pause for a minute to talk about the two biggest federal programs. So I mentioned Section 8 and also the public housing program. The neat thing about those programs is that they're able to serve very fragile and very poor folks in Lane County. And those folks pay rent based on their income. So just a rough example is if their rent is $600 a month, they just pay 30% of their income in rent. So using just roughly that same example, so their rent's $600 a month, they earn roughly $600 a month on Social Security, they're paying a third of their income in rent. So their share would be roughly $200 a month. And the concept behind these programs is that low-income people have other needs. They have medical needs, food needs, and by subsidizing their rent, it allows them to have money to be healthy in other parts of their life. The guy that introduced us announced that we also do weatherization, so that's pretty unique. Most housing authorities don't do that, but those are funds that come from the state to Lane County to us, and we actually have folks that go out many times in mobile home parks, but throughout the county, and we actually weatherize low-income people's homes. One of the other programs that folks don't know a lot about is our Family Self-Sufficiency Program. So that's a program that serves folks on Section 8 and public housing. And we develop self-sufficiency plans for people. They get a savings match as part of that program. So just since 96, we've issued about $1.8 million in savings match. We've created 99 homeowners. So those are folks that have gone from getting a federal subsidy to actually contributing to the tax base by becoming homeowners. So all told, as you look at our programs, people coming in and out, we serve over 5,000 people a year. So I want to share with you a little bit about the strategic vision for our organization because I think it fits with the topic today. Over the next 3 years, we'll increase the number of special needs populations that we serve. I have a particular heart and fire in my belly for helping homeless people. So HACCSA will be dramatically expanding how many homeless people we serve. There's an important effort that I call a preservation effort. So we have existing affordable housing. The average age is over 30 years old for roughly half of our portfolio. So we have to really be thoughtful and think about how we're going to take care of that community asset over time. We will continue to develop new affordable housing, oftentimes in partnership with St. Vinny's, or I know Cornerstone are in the room, Habitat for Humanity as well. Over the last 2 years, we've received 2 tax credit allocations, so we have roughly 100 units under construction. We're going to increase our self-sufficiency programs. So I talked about the self-sufficiency programs. There's also the need to continue to educate about some of the affordable housing issues, and that's why I'm honored to be here today. But HACCSA will play a big role with our partners in expanding advocacy efforts. The other thing is that we have a really old administrative building. We're at the entrance of Alton Baker State Park, if you've seen it. So we do have to find a way to get a new administrative building. Today's presentation is called Assembling the Puzzle of Affordable Housing. The program description framed recent media related to St. Vinny's purchase of the mobile home park in Junction City, and then a recent request we made of Lane County to convert an option agreement to a purchase agreement for the parcel that's at 6th and Oak. I think as important as those two kind of issues are, the media attention on those, the other thing that the program did was it framed a key question for us all to ponder, and that's whether there is a right or wrong answer to addressing affordable housing needs in our community. The easy answer is that there's not a right or wrong answer. For me, the key question is what additional tools do we need to more effectively address the affordable housing needs in our community? So I wanted to talk about the pieces of the puzzle that I think are in place. There's affordable housing providers in our community that have capacity and experience. St. Vinny's, obviously, HACCSA as well, Shelter Care, Cornerstone, who again has folks in the room, sponsors, NEDCO, and Habitat for Humanity. We are all well-run organizations that have capacity to serve the community. Local jurisdictions have supported our efforts. So Eugene's land banking program obviously has been very effective over time. Springfield's leadership on mobile home park preservation, and Lane County's starting to invest in affordable housing. They recently contributed to a project that we have in partnership with sponsors called the Oaks at 14th. And that project will serve folks coming out of the correction system, and Lane County was a tremendous partner in that effort. In 2014, the Poverty and Homelessness Board was created. And this board is currently working on an effort to expand the Housing First units available for low-income people in our community. So there's a real focused effort coming out of that board. And new funding opportunities have emerged. In 2015, our legislature in Salem allocated an additional $60 million of funding. And then in the session that ended yesterday, they did a lot of things for low-income people in affordable housing. But one example is that they lifted the preemption on inclusionary zoning so that our local jurisdictions can implement inclusionary zoning if they choose. So I want to talk about a couple pieces of the puzzle that I think could be improved or pieces of the puzzle that aren't in place quite yet. There's no comprehensive preservation plan for affordable housing. Recently, the City of Eugene and Springfield did begin to convene a body. But as I mentioned, our portfolio, over half of our real estate portfolio is over 30 years old. And some of that is public housing, where I can't go to a bank or an investor and borrow money to fix that housing up. So that's a big concern for me personally. As Terry and I have talked about, there's tools that a housing authority has that haven't been used yet in our community. And one example is project-based Section 8. That's where you take that 3,000 voucher pool that I talked about. You can take some of those vouchers and attach them to buildings and then use those vouchers to serve very vulnerable populations. For example, I talked about our goal of increasing our service to homeless folks. Housing authorities can issue bonds, which is something that HACSA hasn't done. And then we can create local preferences for our federal programs, which we've done some of, but we could do a lot more. And what that looks like is that, you know, if we're working with one of St. Binny's programs that serves veterans, we could have St. Binny's and that program have a preference so that folks that they're serving could get on to our federal programs quicker. Another piece of the puzzle that I don't think is in place is that I don't think there's adequate real estate market analytics here in Lane County. So we really need to be proactive, and when there's parts of the metro area, or I'll use Florence as an example, if those markets start to change, how are we going to make sure that low-income people are still going to be able to be served by those real estate markets? In order to make sure that folks can still be served, you need good real estate analytics. Affordable housing advocacy is another area that actually the Cornerstone folks here and Michelle from Cornerstone led an effort of bringing the social service providers together and the housing providers. But I think there could be a bigger tent for that advocacy effort. So folks in this room, business leaders, and you know, my vision is that over time our local jurisdictions, the cities and the county, actually give more general fund for affordable housing, and I'm hopeful that at some point we can go to our voters and ask them to support affordable housing in a more deliberate and proactive way. So I think I've used my time, and I know that there's the ability to ask questions later, so thank you very much for having me.
Well, the reason more people know about St. Vincent de Paul than the Housing Authority is that we're shameless hustlers. And so we're always putting ourselves out there as, you know, look at us, look at us, look at us. Whereas the Housing Authority tends to take a more responsible role of sitting back and saying, no, actually, we're here for the mission, and we're just not shameless hustlers, and so you don't hear as much about them. I will say, however, that you know, I get to deal with a lot of housing authorities around the United States and in Oregon, and this is one of the best housing authorities I've ever run into, one that really has a clear vision of what it should be doing. Both the leadership that was before, you know, Jacob and in years going back, it has really done an excellent job of being true to its mission, taking care of itself, taking care of the community, and being a very quiet, silent partner with organizations like ours. So, you know, my thanks to the Housing Authority, both now and in the past, for not shooing me out the door when I said, well, why don't we do something really stupid? A number of years ago, does anybody in the room remember Richie Wyman? Oh, you see, what an audience. You guys are great. Richie Wyman had a little graphic about 20-odd years ago that he used to bring to all of the meetings about affordable housing, and it was the housing ladder. I don't know if anybody remembers the ladder, but basically what his contention was is that affordable housing is not about one type of housing. It's not about another type of housing. It's about a series of different types because the truth is that everyone has a different housing need. And as a result of that, you have to deal with the bottom tiers, the homeless and the transitional and the car camping and all of those programs, as part of that continuum that ends up finally in stable, permanent, affordable housing, either in the private sector or in the public sector, and then home ownership. And that has been an effort that we've been working on for many, many years here. And, you know, we've been very, very successful in this community, and I hope you realize that on terms of homeless services. And Dan Bryant's back in the corner. Dan, wave. You know, his efforts dealing with micro-housing and self-run villages like Opportunity Village, I told him a couple of years ago that would never work and he shouldn't do it. And it has worked extremely well. And those kind of efforts, the kind of homegrown efforts that we've had here, the Interstate Emergency Shelter System, the car camping program, the night shelter program, the day services programs, you know, the transitional health programs, the Operation 365, the SSVF programs, we have, as a community, done a really good job of trying to make sure that the bottom tier of people in the housing ladder at least have some opportunities. We certainly have never solved a problem yet, although we're certainly working on a veteran housing right now. But, you know, you always need to be feeding in and trying to deal with that particular part of the population, but you also have to be dealing with the next steps up, and that's what's really hard. Because the cost of developing affordable housing using public resources, the tax credit projects and everything out, really drives up the cost of affordable housing. It's really hard to make those deals come forward, and there's not a huge amount of public money available anymore. It used to be that there was more public money available, but there was a time in this community that we could plan on 2 deals a year going forward to develop housing, over 100 units a year. I think those days are permanently gone. In terms of that federal resource. And there's not a lot of new resources coming forward. There's not a lot of new plans. And so it's really been thrown back to the states and local communities to figure out how you're going to deal with your housing needs. And that's why I appreciate the partnerships that we have in this area, because through efforts like the Opportunity Village and the, you know, rest stops and so forth, and through the efforts of the folks that are pushing forward the efforts to do micro-housing, I think we're going to have some more traction in that area. We've chosen a little interesting area, and it's kind of a small little niche that we had forgotten about and we finally became converts to, and that was mobile home parks. If you think about it, mobile home parks account for about 20% of the affordable housing stock in the state of Oregon. And that's because there's a lot of those parks out there that are the reservoirs where people live, both in urban and rural parts of the state, that are affordable to them. You know, they have a low space rent, they have an old mobile that they live in, and, you know, they want to live it in the rest of their lives. And that housing stock has been vastly ignored. We just haven't thought about what to do with it. In major urban areas like Portland, that housing stock is starting to be converted into housing. And the mobile home parks are being, you know, taken out and replaced with buildings instead because it's an appreciating marketplace. And that's why the state has developed a program about 4 years ago for mobile home park preservation. And so funds are coming forward from the state of Oregon to help make sure that there's funds available for the purchase and preservation of parks, either by the tenants that are the landowners or the trailer owners in the park, or else by a nonprofit that would own it on their behalf. We took a little different tack and we said, you know, what we really should be looking at also is the mobile home parks that are deteriorating to the point and not in an appreciating marketplace. Places like Oak Ridge or Junction City, rural between Eugene and Springfield or Portland and so forth. These places that have old parks and they have trailers that are 50, 60 years old and the infrastructure is deteriorating and they've just been used as a cash cow by absentee landlords. And if those parks go away, the people that live in them have no place to go. They can't move that mobile to another place. It's too old to be accepted by another park. So we've been trying to work on a new strategy of saying, okay, fine, we're going to buy those parks up, and we're going to work with the people in that park to either improve their housing stock or find a way to replace their mobiles with another mobile. Thus far, we've purchased 5 parks in the last 5 years. And would like to continue that process. But the whole point of it is that if you stabilize people where they're at, whether it's in Junction City or Oak Ridge or Vineta or wherever else, you're a lot better than having them displaced, because often they just move into the major urban areas around them. So finding a way to stabilize those populations and then provide human services out there is an excellent way to help stabilize populations where they actually can survive better. The other part of this is, of course, you got to look at how you're going to develop new affordable housing that really can deal with the mushrooming numbers of singles that we see out in the marketplace, and especially those that are dual diagnosed. Often we see that people that are, you know, in difficult life situations have a series of issues associated with being homeless, you know, either driven by living on the street or else coming with it naturally on their own. In either circumstance, we have to meet people where they're at, and that's what the Housing First model is really about. Housing First says, you know, you don't have to be part of a program. You don't have to be in a detox program. You don't have to have mental health services or whatever else. If you're homeless, we're going to try and find a place for you to live. And that model has been something that we've been looking at in this community increasingly. Because if you can't find a way to stabilize a person that's living on the street, you can't do anything else for them. So meeting them where they're at and saying, okay, you have an addiction problem or you have mental health issues, okay, you're going to continue to have those in the future, but we would like to make sure you have a place to stay so you're not on the streets. People on the streets don't get better by themselves. So it's better to find a way to get them into housing and then find ways to go ahead and help them come up with other services, whether they want them or not. If they don't want them, that's fine. But, you know, find a way to get them reattached with the system. And I think that we can all take credit for part of that program with the SSVF program. That's the Supportive Services for Veterans Families, and the mayor's effort last year for Operation 365. During that period of time when the mayor of Eugene and Springfield both came forward and said, we want to house 365 homeless veterans over the next year, was a tall order. But they did succeed. Actually, they succeeded in housing 404 homeless veterans over the last 12 months. But it was based upon the model that, no, we're going to meet people where they're at right now. I will also say that those are nice efforts. Then the question is, how many people actually stayed in the housing? Because if you're homeless and you've got multiple issues, you know, likelihood of staying in. As long as the case management is available for folks and working with them, we have about a 90% staying in the housing, about 90% of the population. So it can be done, and it is a realistic solution. So if you're working on the project-based housing that the Housing Authority is working on, whether you're working on the emergency services portion to shore up the bottom tier of our ladder, whether you're working on the development of new affordable housing projects like Bascom Village that the Housing Authority is currently doing, whether you're dealing with specialized populations like the ones with sponsors, all of these are pieces of that ladder. It requires a lot more local influence. It takes a lot more local money and participation in order to make it come forward. And that's why, again, just as Jacob said, I appreciate the efforts of both the mayor of Eugene and the mayors of Springfield coming forward to attack different parts of this problem. In Springfield, of course, their issue is if Glenwood does develop, which they expect it will, a lot of those mobile home parks will be displaced, and then what are you going to do with that affordable housing? And then I know that they're working very hard to try and come up with solutions on how that will go forward. But by working on an inclusive plan with better, obviously we need to do better. I appreciate that, Jacob. But, you know, the truth is that if we can work together to come up with better solutions, we will indeed make this a very sustainable community for affordable housing. Thank you.
Thank you. Today's topic is Assembling the Puzzle of Affordable Housing. Our speakers are Terry McDonald and Jacob Fox. We'll break now for a few minutes and return with members' questions.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, KMPQ Roseburg. We're on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet. This is KLCC, NPR for Oregonians.
Welcome back to the March 4th City Club program, Assembling the Puzzle of Affordable Housing. Our speakers are Terry McDonald and Jacob Fox. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each. I'm going to take the first question here for you, James Baldock, City Club president. A lot of my friends worry that if we provide great affordable housing in this area, that other transients may move from areas that provide that have less good social services, and this is just an unending problem. How would you address their concerns?
It's one of my favorite questions, actually. And the reason is that when I go to Roseburg, I have the same question. And if I was in Chico a month ago, I had the same question. And when I was in Sacramento before that, I had the same question. And there seems to be a universal belief that our community, whichever our community happens to be, provides way too many services for the homeless. And you're just drawing them like crazy. What we find when we deal with the, you know, the counts we do every year, and when we deal with the Lindholm Center or else the First Place Family Center, is that the vast majority of people that come in for services to St. Vincent de Paul or in their homeless programs are from this area. We don't find a huge number of people coming here because they want to get a better life. People tend to go to where they can find the jobs and the employment and the stability or else around family. And so what we've seen over time is that the populations are basically from here, and they you don't go out and draw homeless people. They're not that fickle. They're not like, you know, butterflies on the wind. So the result is that, you know, all of the communities I deal with on the West Coast, and actually in the East Coast too, are asking the same question, which is how can we deal with so many more homeless people? They must be coming from somewhere. They are. They're coming from our society as a whole. It's shaking out people out of the bottom of our society.
No. Bob Cassidy, City Club member. We have had nearly all the programs that are assisting these people are short of money, and there has been cutbacks from eWeb and City for this kind of thing. What would be your suggestion of how the citizens can get the City or eWeb to return to that business of contributions that they were making, or what kind of programs could they foster this way?
You're a public employee.
Yeah. well, again, I think it gets to a coordinated advocacy effort that isn't just Terry and I and Cornerstone and Habitat. It really needs to be everyone in this room that continues to ask our elected officials to do more. That doesn't mean we want to make irresponsible financial decisions or to have them make irresponsible financial decisions. The way I think about people in poverty is it's the same for me as a road in the sewer. And it's the infrastructure in our community needs to address the issues in our community. We need good roads, and we also need good facilities and opportunities for low-income people.
Thank you both for coming. I'm Susan Conley. I've been a City Club member since 2008. Terry McDonald, you're our housing hero. You really are. I'm so impressed with your work. And I'm glad you've had a good experience with HACSA. I haven't. I've been a landlord for 25 years, serving the working poor, and I don't think I've ever had a good experience with HACSA. So my question for you, Mr. Fox, is something that's been asked of me many times. Why is it that HACSA puts one single person in a two-bedroom apartment that could serve a family or three or four? I think one of the things we have to do is get the most people in housing for the dollar, and that to me has never made any sense.
So that's a good question. So I do want to address what sounds like you've had a poor customer service experience as a landlord. One of the things that we're doing is starting to survey landlords and contractors and ask how can we do better. So I don't know, Susan, the nature of your experience or what the specifics are, but I would be more than willing to talk to you about the specifics. I would also say that we have new leadership in the Section 8 division, and I'm just excited about kind of the new energy and commitment that the two new, the director and the program supervisor has. So again, Susan, I'll follow up with you because I do want to hear the specifics. The question about how a one-bedroom voucher holder could access a two-bedroom has to do with what's called the payment standard. And if the rent in a two-bedroom is low enough, they can actually access a two-bedroom with a one-bedroom voucher. You know, I don't know the specifics or if you have a particular client that you're dealing with, but that's how the program works.
Hi, I'm Ruth Demler, City Club member. I haven't heard the word children or kids mentioned once, and as a former teacher, that's a big concern. And also, I visit First Family, St. Vinny's Center for Families, and I see more and more children. And I'm very concerned. I know that over 50% of our kids that go to school in Eugene are in poverty. And I understand that some school districts in Lane County are over 70%. And I was wondering if families come first when it comes to housing. It seems having kids sleeping in cars is not what we should do in our community.
Children are part of the total package. It's not one population or another. As we say, there's a ladder of services and there's a ladder of need. For the last almost 30 years, the Housing Policy Board has tried to make family housing, workforce housing for families, a priority in this area. And in Springfield, it continues to be that way. It doesn't mean that their problem is not growing. And it's growing largely because of the issues I think I just briefly alluded to, which is the economics of our communities. The best answer to finding a way to help kids, especially that are independent and not living with parents, is to find a way to stabilize them in either some kind of a congregate housing situation, which I think is what Looking Glass is working on now. Or else, likewise, finding a way to have an emancipated youth program where you can actually get them into jobs and employment, which we do, by the way, as well as stable housing. But they need strong mentorship. Family housing with two parents or one parent and children always has been a very high priority for the Housing Authority. It's definitely a high priority for St. Vincent de Paul. Almost all of the development of the Section 42 tax credit deals that are going forward always have a substantial proportion of two- and three-bedroom and even sometimes four-bedroom units. They're just not enough.
The only thing I'd add is in my introduction I mentioned HACCSS Family Self-Sufficiency Program, and that focuses on the whole family, not just the parents. So that self-sufficiency plan includes the goals of the children. The other thing I'd mention with HACCSS is that we do have the ability, again, to have priorities onto our federal programs. I know, for example, the city of Springfield is really passionate about homeless families, and so that would be an area that I think HACCSS could work with the city of Springfield and Eugene and potentially have a preference for families experiencing homelessness.
Jerry Smith, City Club member since 2003. I'm glad you guys are there doing the work you're doing. I know you both have waiting lists that drive you mad and drive me mad. My concern is the bottom tier. Every week I'm meeting somebody new who says they cannot make an application. They don't have the capacity educationally, emotionally, etc. Some of them that have some kind of an income can't manage their income. Is there a payee resource or a management resource or an outreach resource for people on the bottom who just can't make it?
Well, the payee resource is one of the hardest ones, and I think we just lost one of those payee resources here a couple of months ago. Dan, what was that?
Emmanuel Credit,
which was doing that payee resource. It's not a program that we have gotten into at this point, and I don't know a lot of them out there, but it is a definite need out there. I think Mainstream does some of that, as well as a couple other providers in the area. But it is definitely a need. It's also one of those more thankless tasks. It's heavily regulated. You don't want to have somebody just popping up and doing it. You are talking about other people's resources, and it has to be controlled. That's why Emmanuel was really good at it. It was really a work of passion on that. In terms of applications, one of the things that we've learned over the last 12 months working with the homeless population that was veteran was exactly the issue you brought forward. It's very difficult to engage a population that really doesn't know exactly what the rules are and don't have any trust of the systems. So we had to develop the very systems you're talking about, which was no excuse but no judgment outreach to go out and deal with homeless veterans so that we would be able to get them comfortable enough to put an application in so that we'd be able to get them into housing. We're now looking at that as our general pattern to see if we can develop that.
Kathy Ging, when I got into selling real estate 30 years ago, 45% of Eugene was renters, and that's still about the same statistic today, so I haven't been able to make a big dent in that. But right now I'm thinking that I would like to see us be really creative in this community, and I'm suggesting the idea of doing two new lottery tickets that would be for affordable housing and housing first. And they would tap into people like myself who usually don't pay the lottery, and then that would be able to fund these programs. And I've been contacting the legislature, the city council, the register guard, Hacksaw, so I'd like to get a discussion about that. And second, I think if all of us, could put $500 lien on my house without having to pay $700 appraisal, and if the banks would just like charge 1% or 2% interest, we could raise money that way. And finally, Airbnb has 300 rental places in Lane County. Some of them charge $25 a night to $170 a night. And I don't know whether that's being taxed. It may already be taxed, but we could put a surcharge on them. So I'd like to just ask you to think about some of those ideas. Thanks.
Thank you.
Greetings. I'm Paul Thompson, a City Club member on and off since 2003. Thank you for your presentation. Appreciate it. Our table would like to seize upon the idea, Terry, that you had of the ladder and visualize that you've been successful. This is a question for both of you. Been successful in being able to get a roof over somebody's head at the very bottom rung of that ladder. Then what are the programs that nudge the people up the rungs of those ladders? Do you make it completely voluntary on their part, or is there some proactive activity on your part to try to kind of push them up that ladder so it makes room for other people at the bottom?
You want to make a run at it?
Sure. So at the bottom rung of the ladder, as Terry's mentioned, folks have a lot of needs, physical needs, mental needs. So at the bottom of the ladder, in my opinion, there needs to be wraparound supportive services. And then once those supportive services begin to work with individuals, Terry and I have seen it time and time again, people do better. They get better physically, emotionally, and it's time for them to move on. Some of the ways that we're talking about doing that, for example, is if we can create more housing first units at the bottom of the ladder, they could be pretty small, like 350 square feet. And then there's an array of supportive services attached to those units and those individuals. Well, if a person is stabilized, they're not going to want to live in a 350 square foot apartment forever. They might want to apply for one of our Section 42 or tax credit buildings and move on. The other thing is that low-income people support each other. And I believe at the bottom of the rung, if you talk to people about the need for them to, once they stabilize, move into other housing that's less programmed, I believe that folks make that effort.
The analogy I like to make is if you thought of yourself as homeless tonight, and whatever your worldly possessions were on your back or under your arm or on a grocery cart, your horizon of what you are going to do with your life is right now. Your choices that you make are going to be right now because you don't know what tomorrow brings. You don't even know what tonight brings. So you are strictly in survival mode if you're homeless on the streets tonight. And so the typical part of that is that if you, you know, if you come to a person in that kind of a life situation and say, hey, I'd like to offer you some really good opportunities to make better choices, the response is, well, the better choice is you have some money because I could use some food and I'd like something to drink tonight. But if you have a way to stabilize a person and say, your horizon, if you're going to be safe tonight, you're going to be safe tonight. You're going to be safe tomorrow night. And you're not going to have to worry about whether you're going to have a shower, and you don't have to worry about whether you're going to have to scrounge for food or do some corner crusading for some money. Your life begins to change just automatically. The choicing you have available to you comes, your horizon moves a little bit further out. And that's really what we're trying to accomplish in a lot of Housing First, is if you can move the horizon out just a little bit further, a little bit further, people have the freedom at that point to make choices. They don't all do, but at least you're giving people the opportunity to make those choices.
Emily Semple, City Club member as of today. What are your thoughts on Lane County's Poverty and Homeless Board's 5-year strategic plan, especially in regards to populations other than those already served?
So I'm a member of the Poverty and Homelessness Board, and I've had an active role in creating the strategic plan. And the thing I like about the strategic plan, and if folks have had a chance to look at it, there's some very specific goals in terms of number of people served and kind of unit numbers to be developed. And then there's folks, organizations that have experience actually developing. So I think the clear goals are the first I've seen with support from the entire board. The other thing I'd say is that the new money that's come out from the state legislature last year is $60 million. So there is new resource that can be sort of put behind those goals.
John Belcher, City Club member. We had a question about what is the need and how are we doing. So can you give us some idea of what the affordable housing need is in our metro area, and are we gaining or losing ground?
We're losing ground. We're losing ground because of the rising numbers of people that are homeless. We're changing the demographic a bit. Because of the VA funds that have come in for veterans. There's a 3-year funding opportunity to end veteran homelessness throughout the United States. We were one of the cities that or communities that received a chunk of those dollars. So the veteran population actually is doing a lot better. But as was alluded earlier, youth, we're seeing a rise in young folks under 18. That population is growing, or under 22. We're seeing more attrition in families. We're seeing a lot more problems in rural areas. And in urban areas, you know, the more urbanized areas like Eugene, Springfield, where the cost of housing has been rising pretty rapidly, it's putting a pretty hard squeeze on folks. You know, what are you doing about it? Well, you're paddling as fast as you can. But at this point, I'd say we're losing ground.
Dan Solt at City Club since 2008. I'm wondering, back down on the lower level of homelessness, has there been any thought, or have people tried to like make facilities available to them where they can get rid of their trash and refresh themselves and get cleaned up? Seems like that would if people saw homeless people doing that and had the facilities to take care of that, I think it'd be a lot more warmer feeling towards them too. But I don't know what the experience is on that.
Well, we have two day service programs, one for homeless families and one for homeless singles. Then, of course, there's the Mission, which is a huge reservoir of support in this community. But the Lindholm Center on 99, if you want to get rid of your garbage, you bring it in there. If you want a free shower, if you want free laundry, it's available. Same way with First Place Family Center. All those services for homeless families with children are available 7 days a week.
Well, if you're living on the river and you're collecting trash and there's no place to get rid of it.
You're talking about dispersed out
really,
throughout
really
the community.
Really, really basic survival stuff for homeless people.
Yeah. You should talk to Parks and Recreation on that.
Frank Gibson, City Club member since 1990. What's the impact of criminal charges following our homeless people? How can we deal with their fear of police and the legal system?
Go
Well, I think as one of the themes today has been the housing first model, and the housing first model is a model where you screen people in instead of screening them out. And for homeless folks, there are often charges and convictions that are relatively, they're just tied to being homeless, like public indecency because someone doesn't have a bathroom or a number of other lower level crimes that are the result of people having no other option. So again, I think as we expand housing first opportunities, the goal there is not to get hung up on criminal history and to really get a roof over people's heads and then begin, as Terry talked about, to expand that horizon and sort of take those next steps.
Mary Layton, a City Club member since 2006. So at our table, it seems like a perennial question. What do you do about the people? What did you call them? The corner crusaders. Corner crusaders. So if you're taking the bus and walking a lot downtown, you bump into them all the time. And there's always this tension between being nice, however that works out, and ignoring them. It's hard to know exactly what to do when somebody at our table said you could give them a card that says, basically call Terry McDonald or call Jacob, but whatever the proxy for that is. But what is...
Don't do that, Mary.
What is a reasonable response?
Well, this is mine. I think the reasonable response is doing what you would do with any other human being that was attempting to get eye contact. You give them eye contact and you give them a friendly word. And the friendly word is, hi, I hope you're doing well, and I hope it's a good day for you, and I hope you don't get wet, and have you thought of availing yourself of your services out there, because there are services out there. I think that it's important to preserve human dignity, and one of those ways is not to ignore people. I don't know about you, but if I'm trying to make eye contact and somebody is studiously avoiding me, it diminishes me as a human being. But if somebody reaches, whether you give them anything or not is a different issue, but if you reach over and you say, at least reach out with your eyes and your mouth and say, you know what, I acknowledge you as a human being. No, I'm not going to buy what you're selling, but I appreciate that you're here and that you're a human being. So that's one. The second part is that, we get to see almost all of these folks and because we give them the free breakfast and we give them free lunch and we give them the laundry and we give them the shower and we give them the vouchers for clothing. I mean, any given month, St. Vincent Paul gives about 30,000 garments away. And so it's not like that those resources are not available. So understanding that, we don't want to take for granted that people have difficult life situations, and they do. But I think the most important thing you can do for another human being is acknowledge that they're there.
Sandy Erickson, City Club member. This is an election year, and you have a whole room full of potential campaigners. And you mentioned that the city could do more. Parks and Rec just came up. Can you give us a list of exactly what you want the city to do? And I'm sure people in campaign debates and things like that will ask some good questions.
You shouldn't answer this.
Right.
And I don't lobby, and I'm precluded as a 501c3 from lobbying. However, I have some opinions. Several years ago, we as a community in Eugene, chose to diminish any public fund or any general fund dollars out of human services. About 5 years ago, about $1 million a year went into human services of one type or another, and that was eliminated 3 years ago. And I do not understand why that was needed. To be honest with you, the community has very few ways, structurally and physically, to give back, and one is general fund, and I'd like to see that restored. Eugene Water and Electric Board, has the funds that they've been very generous with over the years, and Bob Cassidy was on the board, I think, during that period of time when that was put into place. But I would very much like to see those funds continued, and I'd like to have them guaranteed as continued rather than just every year, you know, putting the tin cup out and hoping that it does get guaranteed out there. I think it would be nice for us to take a look at things that we can do as both communities, Eugene and Springfield, around the property tax exemption and SDC waivers. You're going to develop a lot more affordable housing if you have some local participation in terms of what the community gives in SDC waivers is what is done in Eugene, and Eugene's much more successful in getting affordable housing stock, and in Springfield does not do that, and they're less successful. There are ways that you can spur this on. It's kind of like MUPTI for nonprofits. So I think it's, you have to examine your own community's roots and your own values and then go back and say, you know, if we're going to have this problem solved, we have to have some skin in the game. And there are multiple ways to do that. And a public official should tell you what their plans are to get their own money into the game.
Thank you, Terry McDonald and Jacob Fox, for bringing clarity and vision to this City Club program, assembling the puzzle of affordable housing. And thanks again to our sponsors, Yo Academic Extension, the Network Charter School, KLCC, and the Collegian. Special thanks to Palo Alto Software and the City of Eugene for hosting sessions of the course on Lane County's Economy and Employment, which City Club offers for teachers in collaboration with Lane ESD and Lane Workforce Partnership. Join us on Thursday, March 10th at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Eugene for the program Better Health at Lower Cost, What's a Community to Do? The Social Determinants of Our Health. And then, on Friday, March 11th, we are in 145 Straub Hall at the University of Oregon for a wrap-up of Oregon's 2016 legislative session. Both sessions begin at 7 p.m. We're not going to have our standard lunch meeting next week. Additional information about these programs, parking, and lunches will be available on the City Club's website. I wanted to thank both of our guests for a wonderful time today and a very informative program. Let's give them a round of applause.